Welcome to the Journey to Midwifery podcast. This is a podcast for and about midwives. This is the place where midwives come to share their stories. I am your host, Amber Wilson, a midwife myself. I felt called to this journey of sharing the stories of midwives around the globe, and I hope that you will find as much joy listening as I do interviewing. Remember the quote, "Life is about the journey, not the destination." Okay, another interview on the Journey to Midwifery podcast, and I'm very honored to have on Judy, who's going to give us an intro and all your fancy titles and everything that everyone likes to hear. Go ahead, Judy.
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me, Amber. I'll start at the beginning of my midwifery career.
Okay.
Well, I was just thinking about before that. No, let me start.
Well, Judy, before you start, tell us, everybody always likes to know, are you a CNM? I know, but are you a CNM, CPM? Okay. What you, things like that.
All right. Well, I am a certified nurse midwife, retired. I've actually had two careers. I was midwife for 35 years, and then I went into research, and I've been doing that for the last 20 years. So I really had three careers because I was a nurse for 10 years before I started midwifery. So, and I'm a Columbia graduate from 1974. So.
You've lived many lives, Judy.
Yes, I have. Yes. Definitely.
Yeah. So now you can start, say, like, you can start with what first called you to midwifery, and okay, then we can go from there.
All right. My mother had me at St. Francis Hospital in Connecticut, and she was alone, according to her report, for a very long time in labor and very uncomfortable, and had, of course, the routine of the day, which was scopolamine and all of that. And I think that she didn't tell us a lot of stories about her birth, about my birth, but I think that I was influenced by the fact of her being alone in labor, and how awful I thought that was. I didn't like to be alone when I was having a challenge. So I went to Johns Hopkins for my nursing from Maine. And when I was there, I absolutely hated OB, hated it. It was OB of 1960. It was knock them out, drag them out, OB. And very early on in my experience, I saw this young woman who came in, and she sat up through her entire labor. She was actually one of the residents' wives, and he was there with her, of course, because of the privilege. And finally, the OB said to her, you know, if you don't lie down for a minute, this baby can't come out. And so she laid down and had the baby and popped right back again as soon as she could. So that was interesting, because the routine in that day, I would be in the room with women, and they would be wanting to hold my hand, and they would be saying to me, they were drugged out of their gourds, and they were saying, please don't leave me, please don't leave me. And my instructor or the head nurse would come by and say, come out of there and let her sleep. And I just knew that was absolutely wrong, as these people were squeezing my hand to not leave. And then one day I saw these two women. One was in labor and the other one was like, you know, her best friend or something. And she would have a contraction, she would breathe, the other lady would breathe with her. And I had never seen anything like this or heard anything about it. So I asked my instructor, who is that? And she said, oh, that's the new midwife. You know, Hopkins had a midwifery program for a while there. And I knew at that moment that that's what I was going to do. Excuse me, I try very easily. Oh, my poor students,
Judy,
know that about
so
me.
Sweet.
But anyway, so that was it. I knew I was going to do it. But there wasn't really any place to do it at that time. The Hopkins program didn't want part-time people. anyway, so I got married. I had two little children. I taught childbirth education. I was a doula before the term was invented, especially for women whose husbands were in Vietnam. Bringing this back, woo! Mm-hmm. It's bringing up all kinds of feelings. And I learned so much about labor support from those women because they would tell me exactly what they wanted, you know, and what they didn't want. And so that really, really helped to come from that background. I also assisted a physician with home birth, and I had my second baby at home. So I had some experience of that. So when I went to Columbia, I was kind of an oddball because I was the breastfeeding home birth queen, you know, and most of my classmates were labor and delivery nurses. And those days, breastfeeding wasn't really in yet. The book by the La Leche League had just come out, or I don't think it had even come out yet. But anyway, so I couldn't go to school right away because there was no place to go. But finally, I decided to apply to Columbia and move my children. I was getting separated from my husband at that time, and I needed a career where I could support us. And so we went up to Columbia and had a great experience there. Challenging, as always, you know. Even any graduate school requires a change and a growth in you that sometimes you don't always want to do, but it happens whether you want it or not. So from there, I went to Booth Maternity Center in Philadelphia to work, which was the only real family-centered place that was in existence at the time, and with wonderful John Franklin and Mabel Ford. John Franklin was the OB and Mabel Ford was the director of midwifery. And that was just absolutely a wonderful place. And he did so much to encourage my, you know, my self-confidence. I would ask him to recheck an exam, and he said, "Well, tell me about it. What are you not sure about?" And I said, "Well, I think she's this and this and that." And he said, "If you're satisfied with that, I'm satisfied. I don't need to recheck your exams." You know, just wonderful person to work with. And Mabel was unbelievable, like so many other of the senior midwives. And so about 6 months into that experience, excuse me, Kitty Ernst came up. She was trying to help get the Georgetown program going, and she needed the students to come up to Booth because they weren't getting enough births in DC. And so I was the only midwife at the time with a master's degree. Most of them didn't have master's degree, and of course that was a Georgetown requirement. So I became C1, do one, teach one. I became faculty 6 months after graduating from Columbia. And they would come up to Booth two at a time and be on call, you know, every time I was on, but they were on with other people as well, and wonderful people. I didn't turn my phone off, but it's a spam thing anyway. So so that was my introduction to teaching, and I absolutely loved it. And so that next summer then, Marilyn Schmidt took over at Georgetown, and she called and invited me to come down there to be faculty. I wanted to go down there anyway because my children's father was there and I wanted them to have the opportunity to see more of him. So that worked out very well. So I taught at Georgetown for 4 years. Marilyn retired. She didn't retire, but she left Georgetown, went into the Foreign Service. Excuse me. Oh. And so I took over. Well, I helped design the master's program at Georgetown. And the position of director of the master's was open. of the master's program was open. And I thought about it long and hard. And I had been doing home births for 2 years at that point with Joyce Daniel and Kay Beveridge in the DC area, mainly in Virginia. And we had a great practice, and I learned so much from those women and those babies. They just taught me so much that I'm only beginning to realize some of now anyway. But so I was very reluctant to give that up. So I was talking to Joyce on the phone about this decision. And she said to me, Judy, she said, you can always do a home birth practice, but you can't always be a program director. She said, and I know you would do a good job. I know you love that program. So I started bawling. And I knew that that was what I was going to do. And we had already kind of given it, told one person she could have it. So I had to go back and tell her she couldn't have it. And oh, that was very hard. But anyway, so I did a good job there. We had wonderful students. It was in the day when faculty could, you know, we did actual clinical with our students. They weren't all farmed out, you know. It wasn't a very cost-effective model of midwifery education, but it was what was, you know, the norm at that time before Kitty came along with her brilliant idea to make, you know, other learning. We did send everybody out for integration at the end of the program, but from that, before that, they had all their experience with faculty, and that was just an unbelievably wonderful experience. So during that home, my home birth, so this is how the research ties in. I have to tell you this, because during that home birth experience, I had a baby. That baby, I think I sent you the article. It's called, what's it called? I forgot the name of it now. But anyway, if you search on my name, the article will come up. But it's about a case study about intact cord resuscitation. So I had this baby, I probably had been doing home births about a year at the time. And I had this baby that was, the mom's membranes, she wanted a home birth because she'd had her first birth in the hospital and they'd rupture her membranes without even asking her anything. And she totally lost it after that. And she didn't want that to happen again. So she was pushing. And finally, you know, baby would come down to plus three and then pop right back up. And so I knew that we were going to have to rupture the membranes. And she let me after about 20 minutes of that. And the baby came out with a double nuchal cord and was limp and pale. It looked like the worst looking baby I had ever seen at birth. And so I put him down, left the cord intact, put him down, dried him, stimulated him. I was talking to him. And he checked his heart rate after 15 seconds, and he had a good heart rate, but he was still pale and limp and anyway, not breathing. And so I dried him some more. Parents, the mom was up on her elbows. She was talking to the baby. Dad was talking to the baby. They were touching the baby. We were all, you know, kind of working on him. And I didn't want to breathe him. In those days, we didn't carry all the fancy stuff. So it was mouth to mouth or nothing. And his heart rate was just so good. And the cord was so full and just pulsing. You could see the pulsations in the cord. So I knew he was fine on the placenta. I don't know that I knew that so much at that time, though. I think I was in shock too. And after about 2 minutes, all of a sudden, he brings up his right arm. He opens his eyes and he starts breathing ever so quietly. And then he brought up all his other extremities, flexed everything, and he was absolutely fine. You know, I watched him very closely. When I thought he was ready, I put him up on the abdomen. And he went on to nurse very well, and he had a very normal course. And I saw his mother last at 1 year of age, when he was 1 year old. She came in for her annual, and he was doing wonderfully. But I sure didn't understand at that point in time what had happened. You know, I just knew I was lucky. So that's always in the back of my mind, but I knew immediately this was what I was going to do research on. And I didn't even have my doctorate at the time. So I enrolled in a doctoral program. I tried human development, that wasn't good. I tried education, that bored me half to death. So I went to Catholic U and did a PhD in nursing science. And they were wonderful at Catholic U. I got a very good training. I couldn't do my research on delayed cord clamping because I didn't have any access to patients. You know, there was no support, no mentor, no nothing at that point in time. So anyway, I continued at Georgetown until 1990. Then I went down to Alabama. I'm not going to talk too much about that. That was a very difficult situation. Left there after about a year and a half. I got them a huge grant. I had good success with getting grants at Georgetown. And that experience did me very well later on when I went to, you know, write research grants as well. Anyway, started a program in Mississippi and had students from CNEP there with me. And as far as I know, that program is still going. We went to, we did all the Medicaid patients, went to area. I started actually the prenatal care. They didn't even think about prenatal care. They just wanted physicians wanted somebody to do the Medicaid births, and that's why they decided to have midwives. But it's been a very successful program. From there, anyway, I'm just trying to think about what's interesting and what's not. I did a little bit of international work. I did a workshop in Moldova and in Ukraine, and We were introducing family-centered maternity care, and that was an incredible experience with some wonderful, you know, other people who went along. But all this time in the back of my mind, and in my, I had been studying neonatal physiology, transitional physiology, fetal physiology, and so I had taken a couple of other jobs. Like I thought when I went to Alabama, I'd be able to do research, but you can't start a new program in a hostile state and try to do research at the same time. That was just crazy. I couldn't do it. I wasn't motivated to do it. Well, in Mississippi though, I was doing it because I was not doing it officially, but there were wonderful nurses there. And so I got to practice, you know, more of practicing the way that informed my blood volume theory of neonatal transition. but I swear in the 3.5 years that I was there, I don't think I ever called anybody in the evening or night for a baby. You know, if you just let them be, and, you know, stimulate them. And if you need them to come around quickly, lower them down, you know. and it worked very, very well. Most of the nurses, all of the nurses were very supportive too. They knew that it was what was best for babies. So anyway, that was kind of my field test in a sense, when I was actually practicing. So then I came back to Rhode Island. Well, let's see. After the international work, then I accepted a position at Rhode Island with Holly Kennedy and Deb Erickson Owens, two most supportive people I've ever met in the whole world. Just incredible. Because I was a little beaten up after a bad experience that I had in Alabama's part, half my own fault at least, if not more. So I don't know, I was just feeling like I was swimming and getting nowhere, you know. And so I found there was this wonderful PhD nurse at University of Rhode Island who'd been funded by NIH for 12 years. And I knew that she had what I needed to know. And so I went and visited with them. And when I interviewed there, they were very impressed with my ideas about neonatal transition. And she agreed to mentor me. And she introduced me to Dr. William Oh at Women and Infants Hospital. And he agreed to mentor me. So I had that, that gave me access to the babies and the mothers. And so I got incredible support for getting started. Meanwhile, I was trying to teach and we had a little practice at the same time. So it was pretty hectic. So the first study I did, I had no money, you know, no research money per se, or very little. I think I got 500 here or there. So I was on call. So I would go and enroll a woman. And, you know, preemies, usually they don't deliver right away. So you can't just wait around for them to deliver. So you enroll them and then I'd go away and she may never have the baby before 32 weeks or, and it may be right when I'm teaching a class in, you know, Rhode Island. But anyway, I managed to get 32 mothers and babies over 2 years and then applied for a clinical research application for NIH. And I got that. And that was very exciting because I got on the second try. You have to be ready to go back, you know, to do two applications. That gave me 75% of my salary to do nothing but research for 3 years. So when I did, after I got that, then I decided to retire. The nurses, the midwives at Roosevelt Hospital in, no, not Roosevelt. One of the Brooklyn hospitals, his name's escaping me right now, but my daughter delivered there and they let me catch the baby. And they were so sweet. They would say, because I said, you know, of course I talked to my daughter about not rupturing her membranes early and that kind of thing. And so when she's fully dilated, they said to me, is it all right with you if we rupture the membranes now? And then when she had the baby, she was holding the baby. And then about 12 minutes later, she was crampy. So her placenta was obviously ready to come. So they said to me, is it all right if we cut the cord now? So 12 minutes in 2004, that's a long time, you know, and it was wonderful. So the first study that I completed from that 2003 research grant, clinical training as a clinical researcher, we got 72 babies. I had one assistant, and we found that the babies that had a brief delay, these are preemies, right? Okay, I knew nothing about preemies. So I had a lot to learn. You know, I had a lot to learn just even to write the grant. And we found that the babies had less interventricular hemorrhage, less bleeding in their brains, if they had delayed cord clamping only 30 to 45 seconds. But it was interesting because in those days, there were no fancy tables or anything. We just had the OBs wrap the little preemie in a towel and hold him in a warm towel and hold him next to his body for that 30 to 45 seconds. So nobody was stimulating them. Nobody was trying to suction them. Nobody was trying to breathe them. And I think that made it, now looking back at it, I think that made a difference. I didn't realize that at the time. It was kind of totally accidental, the only way we could do it. So anyway, that really lit the fires on the idea of that, the outcome of that study really lit the fires on the outcome of delayed cord clamping and premature babies. When I first went to Dr. O to talk about it, whether he would be my mentor or not, I told him I wanted to study term babies. And he said, no, Judy, you have to start with the preterms because they're the ones that have all the problems. And I thought, well, if he's going to be my mentor, I'm going to do what he says. And he was entirely right, because there was no good, there's no good exciting outcome variable for term babies, except for I have one now, but it's hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy. But in those days, there wasn't any. And so he was right about that. Anyway, so we, with those results, then we submitted another grant. We got more funding that provide the opportunity to build teams. It was very neat to do research at Women and Infants because so many of my former students are working there. So every day I do the rounds to see, you know, what, who was there in labor and if they might be eligible. And I'd always end up talking to one or two of the midwives, which was very nice. At times I felt like, you know, I was, they were kind of my link. You know, they would tell me stories. Deb and I did quite a few educational sessions. We had written the paper on using a somersault maneuver. And so they were teaching that, and people would come up to me and say, oh, I did my first somersault maneuver today, you know? So that was very exciting. anyway, it was very good. Then in 2010, we finally got some money to study term babies. I didn't start till 2012. And the outcome that we were looking at was myelin development in the brain, thinking that the higher hemoglobin and hematocrit the baby's experience would be good to help with brain development. And that required moms bringing their babies in at 4 months of age to an MRI center that was near us. And sometimes it would take 3-4 hours in the evening for them to get, you know, a good MRI. It was totally demanding of the mothers, but they were wonderful when they went along, and we ended up showing that delayed cord clamping, with the babies that had delayed cord clamping had more myelin in their brains at 4 months and 12 months than the babies that didn't have it. And those days we still did, had a control group with immediate cord clamping. We wouldn't do that now because that's not, you know, even ACOG, as conservative as they are, has come out with a statement. And I think that the thing I'm most proud of, I think, is that, not most, but is that the work that I've done, really contributed to those statements, both on the preterm baby and the term baby. So and then even though it was almost 20 years later, we still had, you know, but I'm pretty distressed with this idea that some people are interpreting their at least 60 seconds to mean 60 seconds and then cut it. And that's just so wrong. It's just so wrong. And you know, midwives know that. Midwives are, even if you go back to Aristotle, you know, who worked with midwives, they knew how to give mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. They knew to melt the cord if the baby had no heartbeat or a very low, slow heartbeat sometimes. They knew so much. And I think that's continued, you know, ever since that time. For the most part, except that those that are ordered by physicians to do something different, or like in the European Union, when the lawyers decided that every baby should get cord blood gases to protect the hospitals and the providers, and so people started cutting the cord earlier, just crazy, without any knowledge of the whole process and what happens and that kind of thing.
Your case review was called Making the Argument for Intact Cord Resuscitation, a Report and Discussion. That was the one you couldn't remember the
name. Yeah, that's one couldn't remember the exact name. Oh God. So
that's it's such so cool to meet a person that really contributed to such trailblazing work, really. I mean, to me, that's just like, that's what you do. And it's every day. It's not even a second thought. And you were part of the time when that was just not what you did.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, it's very, very interesting. I guess I'd had enough, you know, midwives are pretty good at manipulating doctors. And thank goodness, because I sure needed that later on. But once you get an R01 research grant, then you're right up there. You know, everybody looks at you like, oh my God, that's great, you know, kind of thing. I mean, it doesn't matter. And that definitely helped. That definitely helped make the difference and get people to listen somewhat.
Did you feel frustration that it took so long, or do you feel like that's just par for the course?
Well, I think it's kind of par for the course. It's going along in different, you know, areas. I think there's a lot of places actually that are doing much more than 60 seconds for term babies. We need to do more for preterm babies, and there's some people working on that research right now too. But you know, I think for the most part, I think midwives believe in it, but don't always know the physiology and don't know necessarily the harm of early cord clamping. And so that's, I've done several articles that have been published in the Journal of the Women's Health and Midwifery, talking to that group. I've presented at the Pediatric Academic Society meetings. That's where I first presented the IVH findings. And boy, I met everyone at my poster that was at all interested in the area. It's a very neat opportunity to go to those meetings, and especially exciting when you have some good information to report. So anyway, in 2017, I knew that our term grant was coming to a close in the next year or so. We still had follow-up to do. Boy, follow-up is really hard. But anyway, and I met this young neonatologist, Anoop Kathiri. I had met him actually in England when we did a conference on intact cord resuscitation, way ahead of ourselves. But we kind of stayed in touch. And so we were at this Pediatrics Academic Society meeting, and he says to me in 2017, we were talking about what's next. And he said, and I said, I don't know, you know, what's next for me. He said, why don't you come out to California and work with me? So I thought about it. I talked to my husband about it, and he was up for it. And so I said, okay, let's do it. He was writing a grant, so I helped him write this grant on milking the cord. So in May of 2018, my husband and I moved to California, not knowing for sure whether we were getting this grant or not, but we found out in July that we did get the grant. And so I was helping there to work on that. Very exciting. Unfortunately, my husband, after we were there about 2.5 years, was diagnosed with ALS, and it was moving extremely rapidly. And so I knew I had to come back to New England to be close to my daughters, and I was gonna need help when he got, you know, more disabled. So we moved back in September, at the end of September, and he just went downhill so rapidly. So he died December 5th of 2020.
No, I'm so sorry.
So thank you. I think just now I'm just beginning to feel like myself again. Mm-hmm. Really, grieving is an incredible process, and it, you know, but I'm getting back there, getting my energy back anyway, so that's good. I miss him terribly, but yeah.
This was your husband after you had your children?
Yeah, this was my second husband. We were together 38 years.
Oh, wow.
So we were
long time
really in the groove together. Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. I thought he was 3 years younger than me, so I thought, you know, he should live as long as me. Because, mm-hmm. But it wasn't to be. So very sweet, very dear man, very extremely supportive of everything. But anyway, so we left California, and Anoop had worked it out so that I could continue to work on the grant. So I'm continuing to work on that grant. We just now analyzed the findings, and we found that the babies that had this milking, so these are babies that were born within 15 seconds. They had to have no tone, not breathing, and poor reflexes. And so then the obstetrician, we randomized hospitals rather than randomizing babies, because you can't really do it. You need a waiver of consent, because obviously there's not time to enroll them, and you can't enroll every mother for a term baby. So the obstetrician had to make the decision, or a midwife had to make the decision to either cut the cord right away or melt the cord 4 times and then pass the baby off to the neonatal team. So what we found was that there were actually the main outcome variable was admission to the NICU, and there really wasn't a significant difference, even though fewer of the babies with milking were admitted to the NICU. It didn't reach significance. But what did reach significance is that there were fewer babies that had severe, moderate or severe hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy in the group that had the milking of the cord. And that article has just been submitted. So we'll see if that gets accepted or not, but I'm sure we can fix it.
So
if
just
not,
4 there were times 10 that, you milk it.
4 times milking. Mm-hmm. And just that little bit helped. There were 10 hospitals involved from all over the place, Canada and the US mainly. And a lot of people, there were 1,200 babies. So around 600 had 600 non-vigorous babies had immediate cord clamping, and 600 had the milking. So that to me is very exciting, because mm-hmm. I think my baby that I had back at that home birth in 1979 would have been a candidate for HIE if he had been born in the hospital and I'd had to cut the cord right away, because he had so much blood in that placenta from that nuchal cord that he was unbelievably pale. He was the same color as the sheet. So fortunately that didn't happen, but I've talked to plenty of people where that's happened. They had to call in somebody and they clamped the cord right away, and you know, the outcome was not good. I got to do, as part of my, it started at Georgetown, I got to do throughout my career about 25 cases of expert witness. I hated them because it's so painful, but I learned so, so much. And the main thing I learned is that in most of those cases, there was nothing that to, you know, there was nothing on the tracing. Some lawyer would take one to sell that looked like it might be a little late, or one variable or something, and try to make something out of it. And I would say it's not the one thing, it's the pattern. I actually wrote an article. It's called the asystole article, about asystole. I wrote an article, and one of my cases is included, and then a case that an obstetrician from Oregon sent me. And this baby was born, he had a nuchal cord and he had shoulder dystocia, and the midwives were taking care of him. They couldn't deliver the baby. They called the OB in, and the OB cut the cord before he delivered the baby. And of course, the baby was quite bad when he was delivered. He had no heartbeat. He had no heartbeat for 25 minutes. And then they gave him a bolus of saline and his heartbeat started. What does that tell you, right? Tells you you need your volume for your heart to work properly. Anyway, it's all in that article on asystole. And both of the babies were the same case. This OB who sent me this case, he said he really liked a recent article of mine. And I think it was the one on about the interventricular hemorrhage. But and he was very upset. He, of course, was sued by this baby that he had. And that baby, of course, died. This baby that I delivered where I was the expert witness that had 25 minutes of asystole, he ended up, he was in the fourth grade reading at a first grade level. His parents were suing because he could walk, but he couldn't run. So it was just, I was absolutely amazed that this baby could do that much. And, having the history that he had. And the lawyers, of course, some big fancy lawyers, some of them are just a trip. But anyway, they were trying to say that the midwives did something wrong, you know, that there's some little decel or something. I think they won that case, which they shouldn't have. But, I think the only thing that, if that doc hadn't cut the cord, of course, they would have cut it as soon as the baby came out, probably. But you just can't do that. You just can't do that. You're just asking for trouble. So I get off on that subject. Anyway, so we came back here. And since what I'm doing now, what I'm doing now is I've just published about 3 or 4 articles with, I work with Ola Andersson, who's a neonatologist in Sweden, and Heike Raab, who's a neonatologist in Brighton, England. When I first started the research part, I went to this European Society for Pediatric Research meeting that was in Finland. That was my first in Helsinki. And I did a poster there on my theory, my blood volume theory, based on the work of this Swede. And I met Heike there. She was the only person that had published an earlier paper, a recent paper. I mean, it was recent in 2001 or two, about delayed cord clamping. And so I said, I'd like to meet you, while I'm in Finland. So I met her, and we were staying at the same hotel, and she took me around to that meeting and introduced me to absolutely everybody. She is just the most wonderful person, and we stayed friends all this time, and Ola is doing research now on, Heike does a lot of reviews. She does Cochrane reviews on preemies and others. And anyway, Ola's doing study on resuscitation with an intact cord with term babies in Sweden. And the Swedish midwives, God bless their hearts, their mean cord clamping time is 6 minutes. And I think he's going to have some very interesting results, I think, which will probably end up supporting what we found in the MINV trial with the non-vigorous babies. I don't know. There's so much I want to do. There's so many articles. I mean, I really want to do an article on intrauterine resuscitation, because so many babies get to the perineum and they've been wrecked. This business of having people on their backs with their legs up in the air. You know, it's just unbelievable. I mean, people, Caldera Barcia showed in 1950 that if women were on their side, that their contractions were shorter and stronger. And every time I used to try to get people, you know, people who weren't moving well in second stage, get them over on their side. And invariably within 20 to 30 minutes, we had a baby. Nurses didn't like it as much because you can't, you know, pull people's legs back and see the perineum as well when they're on their side. But just doing that and doing physiologic pushing. I had this baby at home once that had D cells. He had, and then his membranes ruptured and he had thick meconium. He was 6 centimeters. And I was half an hour away from the hospital. So I called the ambulance and I had this mom in this ambulance ride on her side, not pushing and breathing. And she was wonderful. She did that all the way to the hospital, all 30 minutes of that ambulance ride. She got there, she was fully dilated. She had a very sensible young resident who was on. He delivered the baby. The baby was in great shape. The baby was strong, fine. I can't remember what happened with the cord, but I remember that they decided not to suction him because he was too vigorous. They couldn't have. They'd had to wrestle him to the floor. You know, he was so strong. And I think that's all that being on her side, letting the baby, not pushing hard, letting the baby recover. And I just hate it when I see with these little preemies, people screaming and yelling at the mother to push harder and, you know, just let her on her side, let her be peaceful, let her just let the baby just come out, you know. I think all the babies would do so much better with that. And, you know, the other thing is that gets me is the not waiting for the, for the restitution contraction. So many people do that. I mean, I learned pull on the head, you know, pull down, pull up, get those shoulders. But you know, we really don't need to do that if we wait. Mm-hmm. I've had so many people come and tell me, oh, I had the worst shoulder dystocia today. And I say, oh, okay, tell me what happened. So they tell me what happened. They went through all the maneuvers. And finally, around 3 minutes, they got the baby. Well, you know what happens about 3 minutes, usually 2 to 3 minutes, the mother has another contraction. Mm-hmm. And that's why the baby restitutes and the baby can come out. In 1997, on my way to one of the trips that I took to Moldova, I stopped at a hospital in England. I can't think of the name of it right now, but anyway, and I got to follow a midwife around, and she took me in the room for birth. She told parents I was going to help with the baby. But anyway, I watched her and she did the nicest birth. After the head was born, she waited for the restitution and she gave the mother, you know, the oxytocin that they used to use then, shot while she was waiting for restitution. And then the baby just came very gently, very nicely, a great baby. But we have to rethink some of those, you know, even for midwifery. I haven't checked Varney and I need to check Varney, but, you know, I think we have in there to, you know, assist with shoulders rather than waiting for restitution. So we have to kind of weed out some of those old OB tactics that we got. But, you know, John Williams, the first author of Williams Obstetrics, he wrote in one of the first texts that he recommends waiting to clamp the cord because he knew of some other person who had measured the amount of blood left in the placenta after and several babies and found the mean to be 92 milliliters of blood. That's a heck of a lot of blood. That's for babies. It's mm-hmm. a third of the baby's blood volume, for God's sakes. Mm-hmm. And so it was on that basis that he decided, well, all our more recent geniuses have decided that I guess that piece of information wasn't important, or doesn't really matter that you cut the cord and leave a third of the baby's blood in the placenta. So anyway, so that's what I'm working on. But this article that you read, this one on intact cord resuscitation, it was just last summer that I figured out what happened to that baby. You know, the whole process, the fact that the blood that was coming back into that baby stimulated his heart, right side of his heart, with the chemoreceptors and the baroreceptors and everything, and told him that he was okay, you know, and his heart could really keep going. And I didn't know why babies had poor tone, but it's a simple matter of blood in the brain, especially in the cerebellum. You know, it's just like when you faint, you lose the blood in your head and your whole body goes limp and you pass out. It's because you don't have blood in your head. And these little babies who have no tone, it's because they don't have blood in their heads. Mm-hmm. You know, you just have to give them a minute or 2 minutes and let them get that blood back from the placenta that they've lost. I mean, you don't know, even if they don't have a nuchal cord, they could have had an occult cord, they could have had pressure somewhere. So you just, if they're telling you something, and it should be as obvious as the nose on our faces, but it isn't. The people who are in such a rush think, give me that baby, hurry up and give me that baby, you know, kind of thing. So I'm still working on that group. So,
oh, I can't wait for that article to come out. That sounds like a big, huge game changer.
Which one now?
The one that you just said is up for publication with the HIE.
Oh yes.
And milking.
Yeah. Yes.
Definitely. I mean, they all have been.
That is a game changer. But it won't change it right away, but it's the beginning.
Of course not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that's what shocks me. I know some brilliant neonatologists. I mean, it's the same thing for little preemies. I also did an article called May the Force Be with the Baby. And it's an article, it was based on an article done by these German scientists who realized that, you know, if you want to grow your organs and have them healthy and happy, you need to have lots of blood to go to them. They like blood. They survive on blood. They do better, the better perfusion they have, the better they do. And that's true for preemies. But it's not only is 1 minute not enough in the delayed cord clamping business, but once they get in the NICU, people take blood out of them right and left. Mm. Some of the little preemies in my study had up to 20 cc's removed in the first week or two. It was just unbelievable. So we really need to, you know, they need to address that also. And there are some people looking at micro techniques so that they only have to do a little bit, but then the lab technicians always take extra. We took some blood from preemies in our study to measure cytokines and stem cells. And we tried to keep it absolute minimum, but then we found out that the lab people always took twice in case they couldn't get, you know, one to work. So we don't value blood enough, you know, we don't value it, especially for little babies. So
have you, any of your research been related to the blood volume in the baby and mom's like hemoglobin, her iron levels?
Well, you know that there's no way right now to measure blood volume in babies.
Right.
So yes, with delayed cord clamping, well, there's an earlier paper that showed that even in very anemic moms, if the baby had delayed cord clamping, they had higher hematocrits and hemoglobins, mm-hmm. than women who weren't anemic, than their babies. So it's especially important with that group because, you know how important that is, especially mm-hmm. important when it comes to myelin, but it isn't that. I just did a talk for this Concord neonatal group about last month on what's in cord blood. And I actually need to write that up too. So my things write up. Meanwhile, I'm so trying to, we moved into this house that where the gardens weren't very well taken care of. So I'm also trying to do this while I'm trying to be a gardener. But anyway.
Keeps you busy.
Yeah, it keeps me busy. But anyway, you know, there's 15 milliliters per kilo of red blood cells. And red blood cells have 80% of the iron in our body resides in our red blood cells. So when a baby leaves a third of his red blood cells in the placenta, that's a huge, huge waste of iron. There's almost a billion stem cells, especially for the term, but preterm babies have even more stem cells, and they have more naive stem cells. So they, you know, they can, they're more naive. They can be more things anyway. There's 20 to 30 milliliters of plasma, which is a wonderful volume expander. So rich, full of all sorts of, you know, clotting factors. That's you probably read about that. And actually, I'm remembering now that that's in my article on intact cord resuscitation, what's in cord blood. But the thing that surprised me most recently is that the progesterone in the baby is so high at birth. It's higher than the mother's progesterone by at least a third to a half. The mother has like 170 nanograms per milliliter, and the baby has 270 milligrams per milliliter. And I think that progesterone has such an important role in helping that baby to just distribute all the blood throughout the body, you know, because in fetal life, 30% of that blood volume has been in the placenta. You know, it's always circulating, but it's 30% there. So it hasn't been in this body. So this little body needs to stretch and, you know, absorb and get used to that new blood volume that it needs for those organs. So anyway, when you have time, look at that paper on May the Force Be With the Baby. Anyway, it's very interesting. I mean, explain to me why when one exercises, it makes us feel better. And that's because it gets, when you exercise, you expand your blood volume, and it just gets in every nook and cranny. And I think it cleans it up. You know, I've said that for years, but I never knew why. But this, it shows a beautiful reaction right at the cellular level, this in this paper. And I just thought it was fascinating. And then the other thing that I'm working on now is studying the autonomic nervous system. And it's so interesting. I'm trying to think about how to write it interestingly, but anyway. Well, because, you know, I think everybody talks about how racism affects people's health. And the autonomic nervous system is at the basis of that. Because when you're stressed all the time, things don't work as well. You have more inflammation. You know, in your body, you have more vasoconstriction in your body. And there's a third one that I can't think of right now. But anyway, so if you're worried all the time about your teenage son, every time he goes out of the house, you have to wonder, is he going to get shot? Or is something bad going to happen to him? You know, how could you possibly have normal health, you know? Or if you get dissed every time you go to the grocery store, or occasionally when you go to the grocery store, you know, somebody's rude or somebody, you know, calls you a name or something, you know, just living with a constant threat of, not threat, but that constant pressure of racism. It's just amazing. It's no wonder life expectancy is shorter. Also, for men who are divorced, life expectancy is shorter. Well, what do you think their autonomic nervous system is doing? You know, I had a brother-in-law who was could not forgive my sister, and he was so angry all the time. And of course he died young, you know, heart attack, boom. But you can't, if you can't let go of the anger, you can't, you know, just smiling stimulates your parasympathetic nervous system. It's just amazing. And having a dog, patting your dog, kissing and hugging your dog stimulates your parasympathetic nervous system. And that's your rest and digest. That's your happy, the happy part of your nervous system. Whereas the sympathetic nervous system, fight or flight, you know, ready to fight every minute, ready to, having to be ready to either protect yourself, protect your kids, protect something. That causes the vasoconstriction, which makes every organ in your body more at risk for damage. So anyway, that's my recent, that's my, what my reading they're finding that there's several studies on adults where they're finding that if somebody has higher parasympathetic tone, if they do better with cancer, with diabetes, with metabolic syndrome, than if they have lower sympathetic tone. So it's just, I mean, people are looking at it every which way. So it's just, I knew nothing about this before. I found this paper, it's mentioned in my paper, but researchers at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, did a study where they cut the vagus nerve in lambs. And when they cut the vagus nerve, they found that forcing air into the baby's lungs did not start into the fetal, the lamb's lungs, the newborn lamb did not start the breathing. And everybody believes that. It's based on Dawes and Mott way back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, whenever they did their work, believe that it's forcing the air in that expands the lungs and makes, you know, everything start up correctly. But what they showed was that that doesn't do that, that if the vagus nerve isn't working, if they cut the vagus nerve, then that doesn't happen. So there's more to the idea. So just forcing the baby to breathe is not going to fix it. You've got to have the blood there to, the blood goes right into the right heart, stimulates that pacemaker and that, where the, you know, baroreceptor and the chemoreceptor and all other kinds of receptors that are in all our blood vessels. I mean, it's just, if I lived to be 200, I wouldn't know all the physiology about what happens in the babies. But the parasympathetic, it's very interesting. There are several papers showing that preemies do better. That's why this NIDCAP, this neurodevelopmental care that they're doing in preemie nurseries, where they're being very gentle with the preemies, not, you know, keeping every stressful thing to a minimum. Those babies do better. They gain weight faster. They go home faster. And that's partly because they're exposed to a lot less stress. So anyway, I could go on and on about, oh my God, it's already 12:10. I'm sorry. I wasn't even watching the time.
Don't worry about it. You are so interesting. You're just, you know, I love this stuff. You are like, your brain is so full of knowledge.
Well, I've been accumulating, and I'll tell you this, this parasympathetic, this autonomic nervous system stuff is really very, very compelling. You know, I wish I'd known about it sooner.
It is, yeah. But it's helpful. You're doing all this, and it helps those of us coming up to apply it.
Yeah.
And say, this is why we do. I always think it's so much better, even when you're raising your kids, to teaching them why.
Yeah,
absolutely. Really retain it, understand why, it. Yeah.
Why you need to not have a bad temper and just blow off, you know.
Yeah. Or, you know, why.
To yourself personally and to other people around you.
Right. Yeah. Or why that baby needs blood volume, or why you delayed cord clamping. And it's also important.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were part of history, really.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Don't you feel that way?
I hope I can keep going. I think this bit is kind of, I thought I was kind of at the end when I wrote that last paper, because that finally explained to me everything that happened with that baby. And I felt very comfortable with what I found. But then, of course, it niggled, then the vagus nerve bit niggled me. And so now then I had to get into the autonomic nervous system and what that does. Plus my daughter has, she has postural orthostatic tachycardic syndrome and some other things. And so learning all this has helped me to understand what she's facing as well. So, and of course she had her cord cut early and she was held up for me to see before it was cut, which means she didn't even probably get the 70 milliliters per kilo. So whether that contributes to those two, you know, adult diseases, I'm totally convinced that immediate cord clamping damages children throughout their lives and damages people throughout their entire lives. If you lose that many of your stem cells when you get to be 90, you know, or 80 or 70 even, you know, do you run out sooner, you know, when you need them? I don't know, but I just think, you know, when you look at hypertension in children, there's just so many diseases, cancer in children, there's just so many diseases that that shouldn't be there. You know, they shouldn't be suffering with those things. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, it's too early now to do a long-term study like following children for 10 years. I think for delayed cord clamping, you have to go at least to first or second grade when they start needing, when they start having to really use their executive function to see the difference, because all parts of the brain work together, you know, and if some get damaged because there isn't quite enough blood here or there, what's the effect? But it's too early to start that because, you know, well, you'd have to do at least 5 minutes, but I think even for 5 minutes for some babies, that's not enough. I think that, for instance, there's a paper that shows that the placenta has a role after birth, that it helps the baby clean up like catecholamines and epinephrine, that it's still circulating and helping because it does that during pregnancy. Why would it start in the first 5 minutes when that baby's probably exposed to more catecholamines and epinephrine than he ever has been before in his life, you know?
Yeah.
And actually there's a paper by Graham Paul Glacey out of this Monash group. And he found that in lambs, they asphyxiated the lambs and then they resuscitated them. And then in a third, they cut the cord right away. In a third, they cut the cord at 1 minute. And the other third, they cut it at 10 minutes. And they found that in the lambs that they cut at 10 minutes did not have a abnormal rise in blood pressure, and that the placenta was acting as a reservoir in a way that protected the baby from overshoots in blood pressure and oxygen. And anyway, so he's said he would look at his blood samples to see if the catecholamines or the epinephrine anyway was lower in those particular lambs for me. But that's so important because 10 minutes, and when you think about those little babies with bleeding in the brain, and what if we could even keep their cords, you know, had a way to keep their cords intact longer. So that's what this Concord neonatal thing is. They have a table to do that with, they can keep the preemies going longer. And they found that it took at least 4 minutes in the preemies, in a group of preemies. And one of the studies, it's got all started in Holland, in the Netherlands. Anyway, they did better. So at 4 minutes, by 4 minutes they had some criteria, at least 40% oxygen. I think if they went longer, they could do better, but we'll see. anyway, lots of stuff going on. It's kind of hard to keep up with it all, but it's all very interesting, and it's very. All, you know, comes around. But anyway, thank you so much for this. I should let you go.
All right. Thank you, Judy. This will be fun to share. Everybody's going to enjoy it. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you take care.
And that's a wrap on another great interview on the Journey to Midwifery podcast. If you want to contact me, send comments, things you like, things you don't like, any referrals of people you want to see on the podcast, email me at journeytomidwiferypodcast@gmail.com. You can also find me on social media, Facebook and Instagram, at Journey to Midwifery Podcast. Until next time.